Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Friday, July 10, 2015, as we come to another journey together in the lifeboat of navigating the present and coming chaos. As you know, this show seeks to provide practical tools offered by awesome people for sailing the turbulent waters of our time. And today we have a very special guest who's going to address one of the most common issues I encounter in my work with people as they wake up and prepare for our very uncertain future. That issue, of course, is living with and relating to a reluctant partner. Now, as a life coach, many people contact me because they have awakened to our predicament, but their partner or family member hasn't awakened and very often doesn't want to awaken or doesn't even want to talk about the information that the person contacting me is sitting with. What is even more frustrating is that the conversation about the collapse of industrial civilization or catastrophic climate change has brought to the surface painful issues that were already lying dormant under the surface of the relationship. Now, this is a big ouch for both people, and most people who contact me say that they don't want to take the problem to a traditional therapist because they're afraid of being called crazy or being told to take medications because the therapist thinks they are depressed or bipolar or have an anxiety disorder. Well, my guest today knows this scenario only too well, and she has some very sound, practical, compassionate counsel for people in this situation. I'm talking about Becca Martinson, counselor and coach, who's the husband of Chris Martinson of the Peak Prosperity website and creator of The Crash Course. Now, you can find out all about Becca's work at beccamartinson.com. That's spelled BeccaMartinson. BeccaMartinson.com. And today we're going to have a conversation with her about living with a reluctant partner, or really any family member. Becca is both a certified focusing trainer and a certified focusing professional, and has completed nearly a 5-year holistic healing apprenticeship with Interfaith Ministry Ordination. She lives in Western Massachusetts with Chris and their 3 homeschooled children, their teenagers. For the last decade, she's also served as board chair of the Vermont Wilderness School, and she's passionate about reconnecting people with nature, and she has a great deal of wisdom to offer couples who are struggling with collapse and related issues. Becca, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour.
Thank you so much, Caroline.
Yeah, you know, PRN has a phone line now that can be used by listeners to call in and ask questions of our guest. It's not yet an 800 number. They're working on that. But I will give you the number now, and we'll be announcing it throughout the show. It is 646-490-5448. That's 646-490-5448. Well, Becca, I'm guessing that you quite naturally moved into the work you're doing with folks because of your experience with seeing Chris wake up to collapse and what happened when he suggested you wake up too. But will you tell us a bit about how you came to do the counseling coaching work you're doing, which I'm sure is very related to your story of waking up in the relationship with Chris?
Well, in many ways, I'm just making a profession out of something that I've been doing my whole life. Being in service to the emotional health of others has been something that has been a real passion of mine for a long time. And as I began to gather my own tools on my own healing journey, I naturally wanted to offer them to others. And so much of what I do is really about just encouraging and teaching people how to connect to their deepest self and their deepest truth. And that comes up in the seminars that Chris and I do together, as well as the personal counseling that I do.
Can you tell us a little bit about your experience with, you know, beginning to wake up yourself, or maybe being resistant to that as Chris comes to you and talks to you about that?
Sure. You know, it started quite a while ago. I guess it was about 2001 or 2002 that Chris and I were living in Southern Connecticut, and we were living a perfectly normal, mainstream, American dream kind of life. And, you know, we had three young children and a beautiful home, and just had a corporate job, and everything was just fine. And then one day it seemed like he just went crazy, as far as I could tell. All of a sudden he was really kind of ranting about the system and the way that he really felt kind of victimized by the system, and you know, a lot of fear and concern over the economy. And he had just been doing a bunch of research about the economy, and you know, as he was peeling the covers back, was seeing it quite as a Ponzi scheme that was ready to collapse in any moment. And he was very, very agitated about all of this. And at this point, I figured that this was a midlife crisis. You know, I figured it was just, right, just something going on here, and we would just kind of, you know, ride the wave of whatever this storm was, and everything was going to be fine. So I basically didn't take him seriously at all for quite some time. And in fact, I was pretty repelled by what he was speaking about. It wasn't necessarily the content of what he was saying, but it was the emotional charge with which he was delivering it to me. There was quite a lot of anger and quite a lot of fear. And both of those together caused me to want to take three steps backwards and just go about my very busy life trying to take care of three young children. So, you know, I was absolutely the reluctant partner for quite a long time.
Well, yeah, thank you for that. You know, and maybe we'll ask a bit more about that a little later on. But you have shared with me 10 suggestions that you utilize with people who are facing conflicts in relationships around the collapse issue. And the first has to do with being aware of one's own emotional state. And I notice that these emotional states sound very much like the stages of grief from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Could you say a little bit more about all of that?
Yes. Well, we, of course, this is comes directly from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's work. And, you know, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is her work is dealing with the emotions that people go through when they are coming to terms with their own death or the death of a loved one. And in many ways, all of the material around collapse and the crash course, you know, they really are bringing into sharp relief our own deaths and our physical death that might come sooner than we had imagined, but also the death of the way we thought things were going to be, the death of a lifestyle, the death of the future that we had anticipated. And so we found in our work, and I'm sure you found in yours as well, that people go through a very similar progression of emotions when facing this material, the first one being denial, which is where I was. You know, I don't want to think about this. I don't want to look at that. And another cycle being anger, and just being very angry about the whole situation, not wanting, being angry at the system for creating this system that we are kind of stuck in. Then there's also the bargaining phase, which in our kind of line of work we look at as, you know, what do I have to buy and how can I prepare in such a way that will keep me from being impacted by this? Then there's also, of course, depression, when we really sink down deep into darkness, and despair and hopelessness. Another phase that we add into this is fear and anxiety, which is super common and prevalent. And then finally, there's acceptance. And what we found is that this is not a linear progression. People do not go from one step to another necessarily. And depending on your own kind of baseline psychological construction, some cycles, you know, might be stronger than others. You might stay in a depressive stage longer or an anxiety stage longer than someone else. And that you may cycle through these emotions many, many times. But in delivering this kind of information to a reluctant partner or to someone who does not yet have the information. They might not be in denial, but they might be in a state of ignorance, meaning they just don't have the information yet. Knowing where your own emotions are and the impact of those emotions on the other person is essential. So in my case, Chris was both angry and fearful. And because he was delivering the information to me with the emotional charge of anger and fear, honestly, it didn't matter what he was talking about. Because of who I am, I really wanted to shy away from those emotions. I did not desire to step forward and meet and greet him in that state holding those emotions. I really wanted to just step back. So understanding and knowing where your own emotions are and that those emotions will have an impact on the person that you are talking to is essential.
Yeah, and before we go on to the next question, Becca, I want to make sure folks know how to get in touch with you. Your website is beccamartinson.com. Is there any other way that that people should find you?
Yes, they can find me through the website, and they can also reach me at becca@peakprosperity.com. That's my email address.
Okay, becca@peakprosperity.com. Yeah, you've been featured a couple of times on Peak Prosperity, some of your articles and a podcast, it's really good to see you out there and getting this exposure, because there's such a huge need for people to be able to talk about this.
Yes, there really is. And most of my relationship with the work at Peace Prosperity is through the in-person seminars that Chris and I do every year at Roe Seminar at the Roe Conference Center, but we've also done them all over the country. And I'm really an in-people person, and I really like working directly with the people that gather at those seminars. It's quite a joy.
Well, you know, since you mentioned that, why don't we go ahead and talk about those seminars? Because, I see your advertisements of those every year, and Roe is a fabulous place to do a conference. So what happens at those seminars? What are they like?
Well, you know, it's so interesting. People fly in from all over the country for these. I mean, really. And we've had folks come from Europe and Mexico. I mean, people come from all over. And I think what they're really seeking more than anything else is to be in a room with other people that don't think they're crazy.
Right.
There's something so relieving and satisfying to be able to sit in a room with 80 other people and just know that you can talk about any of this material straight up without anybody judging you or thinking that you are nuts. So we find that people, actually, we have a lot of people that come back year after year, really just to connect with the community that gathers. It's quite a lovely community that gathers. And what we tend to address is, we make viewing of the crash course the prerequisite for the seminar. And then the seminar is really about, okay, so now what? So you've seen the crash course. You understand the elements of collapse. What does that mean for you in your personal life, in your family, in your work, in your community, in your relationships? So we really do a deep dive into, okay, so now what do we do?
Right. Well, let's go back to this whole thing of, you know, bringing up the subject. You've got the one partner who's waking up. You've got the other partner who isn't there yet. You suggest that it's really important to have a specific time and place to talk with the other person about collapse, almost like an appointment. And I really like this because it communicates, first of all, that this is a very serious issue, and it communicates that the time that you're setting aside is sacred. It deserves to be focused and protected from other concerns in the daily routine. Is that how it feels to you?
Yes, exactly. And if I could have, you know, gone back in time and given Chris that advice, it would have helped immensely. Because what I found was he was trying to talk to me about this material kind of while I was making dinner or while other things were going on. And I was highly distracted and not being able to focus. And that, in combination with the emotional charge, made it so that I was contracted and was not able to listen. So what I really recommend is that people make a date to sit down and talk. And in doing so, that also really helps, I think, the person that is delivering the information to take a few deep breaths and get grounded, get settled, and enter the conversation from as calm a state as possible. And doing this is going to make it immensely easier for the person receiving what is, as we all know, very difficult information to receive. It is not easy. But it's going to make it much easier if the person that they love, who's delivering the information, is doing so in a centered, calm, and grounded way. And again, with that nice container around them, so the phone isn't ringing and it's the email is not pinging at you in the background and the kids aren't there. It's a sacred time and space outside of regular life in which you're choosing and agreeing to sit down and really listen.
So that, of course, leads me to my next question, which is, you know, we know that being anxious and scared isn't the best way to go into this conversation. So what emotional condition should one be in when bringing this subject up to the partner or family member, and how does one get there?
Well, that's the real question, because it's all well and good to say, I think, you know, you should be calm and collected and centered and grounded going into the conversation. But if you're actually anxious and completely freaked out, then, you know, that's a little tough to manage. So what I would recommend would be some self-reflection in the beginning. So if a person is entering into this conversation, it's really important for them to do some self-reflection beforehand to say, what is my emotional state around all of this? How do I feel? And to maybe even take a minute or two to just greet and say hello to the part of themselves that is very angry, that is super anxious, that does feel hopeless and depressed, to just welcome those aspects of yourself and you know, let them just say hello, like, yes, I know you're feeling really anxious or depressed or sad or whatever it is. And, you know, right now in this moment, my intention is to go in and have a conversation with my loved one in which I would like that person to be able to receive and open to hear this information. And so there's like an opportunity here to consciously set aside for a moment those emotions, to step back from them enough to say, I know I'm scared, I know I'm angry, I know I'm depressed, and I'm going to, if possible, just put those parts of myself kind of in a waiting room for a period of time so that when I go and have this conversation, I can do so. I have a much better chance of doing so from a place of being grounded and centered and calm. And I really, really recommend breathing, that doing some just slow, 10 slow deep breaths is extremely helpful before beginning a conversation like this. And also to really acknowledge what, before even going in, that this is hard information to hear and that this information could very well bring up all of those same emotions in the other person. And so to be prepared, like if I'm going into the conversation, I know I might just trigger anger or fear or depression or resistance of some kind, to know going in that that might happen, and to just prepare myself going in that is very well could happen, and I need to be ready to just be present if possible.
Thank you for that. That's really wise counsel. And, you know, it's really important to take time with this. You know, for me, it's like when I work with folks, when I work with the partner who's awakened, you know, I really want to support them in doing this self-reflection, and that's a process. Yeah. You know, and I recommend journaling. I recommend, you know, taking a walk in the woods, you know, or being out in nature by yourself without any agenda and just getting yourself centered.
Yeah.
You know, and writing down what is it I really want to communicate. And I don't know about you, but I have found that it's really important for people to be sharing from their heart. And one of the reasons I wrote the book back in 2011, Navigating the Coming Chaos, a Handbook for Inner Transition, is to put out a huge catalog sort of emotions that come up around collapse and how to deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
And to prepare ourselves, you know, I have lots and lots of tools in there in how to work with these emotions. And people have found those very helpful in terms of, you know, how do I get ready to talk to a partner? Mm-hmm. And, you know, somewhere that I read, oh, I know, it was your article about dealing with a reluctant partner. And you talked about how Chris finally came from his heart and he said, I need you to know this. Whatever it was, but it wasn't like, you got to see this documentary, you got to read this book, here's the facts, here's the information, but rather he came more from his heart. Isn't that kind of what happened? We have a question, I believe, from Harvey. Could we go ahead and talk to Harvey? Hello.
Oh, yeah. Hello.
We have a question from Harvey.
Am I on
Harvey,
the air
would you go ahead?
At this point? Good. The whole idea of talking to a partner is really, really fascinating, and I'd like to just share a little bit what's happened to me.
Sure.
You know, I know we live in a culture in which the predominant thinking is denial that anything like this could possibly happen. And so I need to get away from the radio for a moment. And so I basically had to go this course alone. I'm at the point where, having gone through all of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's phases, I'm in the point of acceptance. And the rather extraordinary thing about being in this place of acceptance is that I have become more joyful and more alive and loving my life, even though I sense it may well be short. However, my wife continues to be totally caught up in the day-to-day of it, and I have to let her be that way, that she's very resistant to any information at all, and she seems to reflect the society very, very well. And even though I tried to go at it either sometimes in upset ways and angry ways and calm ways, I think ultimately I just have to let her be where she is and stay in the denial as long as that's what she chooses to do.
Well, I really appreciate your comments, Harvey. You know, it's so true that when we come to a place of acceptance, you know, you know, this is what I say in all of my work, whether we're talking about the possibility of near-term human extinction or we're talking about the collapse of industrial civilization, it's really important to come to a place of acceptance. And when we come to that place of acceptance, which is very, very challenging, by the way, it's not easy, then we can begin to live life in the moment more empowered, even as people around us aren't seeing what we see. Becca, did you have would you like to comment on this?
Sure. I just want to really agree with your response that once you've come to a place of acceptance and your partner really has not and is very much aligned with the dominant culture, that might just be the way it is. And one of the things that I've noticed in working with reluctant partners is that not everyone is built to engage with material that flies in the face of what the dominant paradigm is saying. It takes a certain kind of person to be able to hold a different perspective than what is being blasted from every TV in the nation. And blessings to your wife exactly where she is. Like, that's where she is. And, you know, many times it will not be the partner that can deliver the information. But once this, you know, who knows? Maybe it's the Pope. I mean, it might, you know, it's, you know, now that we have that trusted source for, you know, a billion Catholics on the planet, you know, speaking truth about climate change, it might be that channel that she trusts and begins to listen to. Or it might be, you know, once this material starts getting talked about on her favorite talk show, then that is the moment that she'll be able to engage with it. But she's going to have to hear it from a trusted source for her. And who knows when that will happen. But I think that in the best thing to do is exactly what you're doing, which is accepting her exactly where she is. Because that acceptance of her being where she is gives her the room, gives her the space to be able to step towards you into this challenging material if and when she's ready to.
Yes.
Thank you.
May I make two comments on this?
Yes, go ahead, Harvey.
Well, first of all, God bless the Pope for that. There's most of the stuff that the Catholic Church does, I find, is very difficult for me to accept. But God bless him for supporting the situation as it is. That's number one. Number two, most of us, I think, in this world do everything we possibly can to survive, or also known as what it is we can do to be safe. And the preppers, I think, generally make an unfortunate mistake because they think in terms of survival at all costs. And I think this is not what's going to be useful. I'm more with Caroline Baker, what she says. She looks right into the abyss and asks the question, how can I live the greatest possible life, the most contributing, most compassionate life in the face of the danger that we're looking at, which well may be extinction of ourselves as species? I don't think it will. I think that we will come out the other side of it much smaller, but possibly have shifted from our present paradigm of you or me to the paradigm of you and me, you know, with a world that works for everyone. So when we look back at this, you know, from thousands of years, we may look back upon and say, ah, yes, the time when civilization truly began. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Harvey, for your comments. Appreciate all of that. Becca, you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay. Let's go back to right before the interruption that we had. Let's go back to that place of, because I find this so common, and I'm sure you do too, that it's really important that when we do have this talk and we have done the self-reflection, that we come from a place of the heart, you know. And, you know, I even suggest to people that sometimes instead of saying, read this book, read this article, watch this documentary, with the illusion that if they just read one more thing, they'll get it, I suggest, you know, allow yourself to be vulnerable with the other person. Allow yourself to say, I'm really scared, you know, and I'm really sad that we can't align on this, and maybe we never will, but I just need you to hear the sadness. I need you to hear how important this is to me. And I think that's kind of what happened with you and Chris.
Yes, that's correct. And I thoroughly agree with you that coming from the heart, from that place of vulnerability and truth is essential, because this is not about information. We might think that if we just give them enough information, then that's what's going to turn the corner. But it isn't about information. It's really about the beliefs that each of us carry. And what is happening with this information is the information is challenging some very deeply held beliefs in the other person. And that is really hard. And so, you know, coming from the heart and being vulnerable and truthful, I think, is the most effective approach. And also to really know in advance, what is your intention for the conversation?
Ah, good point.
And if you can state your intention to yourself and then state your intention to your partner. So your intention might be something like, my intention is to let you know how I am with all of this information and what it's like for me to not have unity with you about this. That might be your intention. It's just sharing what what it's like. Your intention might be also to just say, my intention is to communicate some information that I'm not sure you have yet. I'd like to give you some information. So think about what that intention is before you begin.
Great, great advice. And I just want to remind listeners that I'm speaking today with Becca Martinson, counselor and coach, regarding dealing with partners or family members who are not on board with the global crisis. And I urge you to go to her website at BeccaMartinson.com. That's BeccaMartinson.com, and learn more about her work. And meanwhile, if you have a question or comment for Becca, please know that you can call us at 646-490-5448. 646-490-5448. Now, as you said earlier, sometimes people can hear things from someone else in their lives, but not their partner, and some people can never hear it. It's terrifying for most partners who are on board to entertain the possibility that their partner may never get it. Would you care to comment on that?
Yeah, this is a really, really tough one. And so I invite people to actually, as that previous caller said, stare into that particular abyss. Okay, what would that be like if your partner really didn't get it ever? And what would that feel like inside for you? And be present with those feelings that come up, with that possibility, and really think into the future of, okay, how would I step forward with myself knowing this information, wanting to take action, with my partner not being on board now, perhaps never being on board, and what is the compromise that I would be most satisfied with? Would I be most satisfied with just having my partner being willing to let me take the steps that I know I need to take to protect our family or to help our family prepare? Would you be willing to just allow me to do what I feel is most important right now? That might be the compromise. But I think that really being present with the feelings that come up when facing that possible reality is really important. Because what happens is when we face that abyss, oh my God, my partner is not going to be able to ever see this information. What am I going to do? Boy, does that bring up a lot of anxiety and fear and anger and, good Lord, everything under the sun. So then you've got an opportunity to do some self-reflection there and be really present with what emerges.
Wonderful advice. And, you know, I just have to ask you, now going back to you and Chris, what actually did it for you? I mean, when did you cross over the line? I'm really curious.
You know, it was really in his change in tone. That's what did it for me. When he was coming at me with anger and fear, I stepped back. And when he stopped and said, I am looking at the world through a particular lens right now, and it has huge implications for for our family. What I see has huge implications for our family. And I really need for you to look through this lens with me and tell me if you see the same thing. And if you do, what do you think are the most prudent steps for us to take? And it was that framing of, first of all, the change in tone, and second of all, I am seeing something here that causes me to reassess our entire life. And boy, did we make some changes, let me tell you. And it was that shifted it for me. And of course, at that point, there was no crash course. There was no
right.
Go and watch these, you know, handy-dandy videos that are online, and you get all the information in this tidy package. You know, he was, you know, I always joke that he didn't leave love notes on my pillow. He left economics papers on my pillow.
Right.
And, you know, sent me links to various websites to look at. And I had to really educate myself because I didn't have any training whatsoever. And, in fact, I had a lot of beliefs internally that I wasn't I wasn't interested in things like economics. I wasn't interested in these types of things. I wasn't very good at it. So I had some my own personal hurdles to deal with just engaging with the information long enough to begin to look through that lens that he was looking through. And when I did, I saw the same thing. And so it was a really easy and beautiful next step for us to then work together to reassess our lifestyle at that moment, which was, you know, living in a 6-bedroom, 5-bathroom house on the coast of Connecticut, you know, without any community whatsoever, not any connection to our food or, you know, our energy sources. It was just 100%, you know, in the middle of the America, you know, so-called American dream. And we changed the entire thing.
Yeah, you moved to Western Massachusetts, I believe, and then, you know, you got conscious about food, and you got conscious about, I'm guessing, education, because you're homeschooling your kids. So can you say more about the changes?
Sure. We really just changed everything. We moved from a ginormous house into a small rented farmhouse. We threw out our television set. We took our children out of school and began homeschooling. We began growing our own food and, you know, started raising chickens again. We had previously lived a kind of a similar life to this during our college years. So it wasn't like this was unfamiliar or like new territory. Mm-hmm. But we essentially, you know, went back to our roots and said, oh, yeah, remember that way we used to live? Let's just do that again. Got very deeply involved with our local community. That was probably the most important aspect of all of this is the relationships with the people around us. So we did a complete 180, and as we always say, our standard of living dropped considerably, but our quality of life improved immeasurably.
That's beautiful, you know. And in terms of partners, whether we like to admit it or not, and you alluded to this a while ago, most people in this culture are so highly influenced by the mainstream media that in that venue, there's virtually no connecting the dots. People talk about climate change, but they aren't connecting how severe it is and how late in the game it is. Yeah. People talk about Greece, for example, and recessions and unemployment, but they aren't connecting with peak oil or inflated stock markets or the frightening amount of debt that most families and most countries in the world are carrying. So it's very difficult for a partner who's being introduced to collapse to feel validated in learning more about it and accepting the reality of it when everything in mainstream media tells us that everything is fine. So this means that when you want to introduce your partner to this material, you have a whole culture going against you, right?
Yes, you do. And it's really, really tricky. It's super tricky because, yes, everything in the culture is putting a big old smiley face on all that is, and so it's very, very difficult if one is fully immersed in that dominant culture to be able to even peek their heads up out of it and see something else. This is why I think that Chris's work with the Crash Course is so valuable, because the way he structured the Crash Course in these tiny little chunks of information, these short little chapters, it is very uncharged. It is not it's not fear-based. It's very grounded and just information-based, and it builds the case quite slowly and carefully. And so I think that is an amazing resource for people that are working with reluctant partners. But another suggestion might be to look into your partner's life in their relationship in the dominant culture and just see if there's any aspect in their life that is outside of that dominant culture. For instance, perhaps like things that used to be outside of the mainstream, like yoga classes, for instance, are now heavily in the mainstream. Or even alternative medicine is kind of coming out of the corners. So, you know, is there a place where the partner is participating in some aspect of an element of culture that is not highly supported by the mainstream, and maybe working through that channel, working through that lens to then look into the broader picture of the economy and the energy environment, climate change, and all of the various other things. You know, what's that first stepping stone that might already exist in that person's life that you can begin from?
Well, let's take an example. I mean, for example, let's say that your partner is interested in alternative medicine. And they may see a naturopath, or they may do homeopathic remedies and stuff like that. So then how do you make the leap from that to collapse?
Well, I think that what I would do is not jump straight to collapse from there, but to look at assessing the dominant story from there. So you might say, well, you've chosen something really different than what the mainstream medical establishment recommends. You know, why did you choose that? Why are you using homeopathy? Why are you going to a naturopath? What about that feels like truth in your body? What about that really resonates with you? And so you build the connection to that. And then you could say something like, you know, in my experience in reading about collapse, it feels similar to me. Like the mainstream story says one thing, but I really know in my heart of hearts that something else is very different. Just like you feel that the alternative medicine is the right choice for you and for your children and for your family, I also feel that this material is essential to look at, even though it's not being talked about in the mainstream culture. Just like your alternative medicine is not being talked about in the mainstream medical establishment. So you see how you're building a bridge.
Yeah.
You're finding the connection. Where can we find connection with each other in a place that is slightly outside of what the dominant story is telling you is true?
Beautiful. I really like that. Now, from time to time in my coaching, and I'm sure in yours as well, we encounter a partner in a relationship who, or maybe another family member, who's openly hostile to the other person talking about and preparing for collapse. What would a person do, or should they do, in a situation like that?
What I tend to recommend is for people to not engage. If somebody is really, really hostile, what I take from that is that they've got some major fear that has been activated in their systems, that they are deeply triggered, and that it might be coming out as saying, you know, I'm hostile to you and this information, but there is another story that is playing out deep in their unconscious mind, and that pushing against that hostility, fighting against that hostility, is only going to encourage isn't the right word, but it's going to enervate it. It's going to enliven it even more. So I would just acknowledge the other person's emotions and say, I hear that you are really feeling like this is complete hogwash and you don't agree at all, and you're really angry that anybody's even bringing it up. I hear you. Mm-hmm. I would acknowledge their emotions, because if there is open hostility and anger towards this, it needs to be acknowledged. And I'll acknowledge that each person has their own truth, and this is theirs, and they're feeling it very strongly, and it needs to be acknowledged. And I find that just acknowledging and allowing that person to be in those feelings without having them diminished or judged or, you know, told that they're wrong is a much better way to allowing those feelings to subside just a little bit, maybe make space for something else to enter, or not. And it's just like with the person who is with a partner who is thoroughly resistant, perhaps not hostile, but resistant, and is not going to change, just let them be the way where they're at. You're not going to, you know, going at it stronger is not going to help.
Absolutely. That's very wise advice. Now, Becca, you and I both know that we live in a culture in which people are highly traumatized. I firmly believe that none of us escape some kind of trauma, because trauma is pretty much the way of industrial civilization. We like to point our fingers at third world countries and say that life is so hard there and that our lives are so peaceful and tranquil by comparison. But in fact, we suffer trauma on much subtler levels that may be more emotional and spiritual, I think. We also obviously store that trauma in the body. So whenever we partner with someone, or even when we relate to other family members, we're having to navigate our own trauma and that of the other person in some way. So what I'm getting at is that often in a situation where a partner or a family member will not look at collapse, it isn't because the awake partner hasn't presented it correctly. It may be that marital or family distress is already there, and that talking about collapse only complicates the whole issue. And sometimes we want to blame collapse for the conflicts, but it's something deeper that's going on and has been there even before the issue of collapse entered the picture. What are your thoughts about that?
I agree 100%. I think that just the process of socialization in our culture and in most cultures is very traumatizing, and that the industrial culture is very traumatizing, and that every person has some degree of trauma stored in their body, which is persistently being activated in ways that we're not aware of at all. Any time that we have a strong response to another person, to a situation, if we really track it back internally, it's going to some trauma somewhere inside us. And so, yes. And, of course, I mean, all couples have their challenges that are based on the intersection of one person's traumatic body, you know, stored body trauma, and the other person's stored body trauma, and the way they come together. And most of the time, it's not conscious at all. So we don't know that that's what's actually playing out at a deeper level. And so we point at the other person, we point at the issue, we point at collapse, we point at the whatever it is that seems to be the thing that's making us upset. We point outside ourselves. And the truth is that the source of that is old. The source of that is in our childhood, and it's deeply stored in our bodies. And there's sometimes, if people are willing to just be present with that possibility, it can make it easier. And also for the person that is trying to present the collapse information to the other and is so frustrated by the lack of the response that they want, I find easier to get to a place of compassion if we can understand that what is happening here is not what it looks like on the surface. What is happening is there is somebody in there that is really, really scared, and they are showing their fear. And, I mean, this is really scary information, even without starting out with a traumatized system.
Absolutely.
But we have the traumatized systems. Everybody does. So that is, it just makes it extra tricky. So this is not an easy road for people to walk on. And I really recommend that finding like-minded people to be able to talk to is really helpful. And again, on Chris's, I'm sure through your site, Carolyn, people can find like-minded folks to share mm-hmm. what it's like to talk to a reluctant partner. I mean, you got to find your people to talk about this with. It's just too hard to do it in isolation. And I know on Chris's website, Peak Prosperity, they have a whole group set up to talk about this. So find your people wherever you can. And luckily, we have this phenomenal tool of the internet that allows us to connect with people with similar interests across the globe. So there's no shortage of people to talk to.
And I also want to recommend, in addition to that group on Chris's website at peakprosperity.com, on Facebook, you can connect with the Near-Term Human Extinction Group, the Near-Term Human Extinction Love Group, and the Whistling in the Dark Group. Whistling in the Dark is primarily for parents and families. So there are many, many ways on Facebook that you can connect with folks of like mind and heart. So you know, a lot of people come to me because they say, I don't want to talk about this with a therapist. And I totally understand that, because so often people think I'm going to be called crazy, I'm going to be prescribed medication or whatever. But I believe there are situations between reluctant partners where it is wise to seek professional therapy. What do you think?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. Because just as you were referring to before, the underlying issues that are at play in the relationship have nothing to do with the subject. And so those are the deeper issues that really need to be exposed and sat with. And so frequently we need a third party to sit with us on that. It's just too hard to do it alone. And so I definitely recommend seeking professional counsel. And I think that more and more these days, that you can find more people that are willing to be present with the collapse information, and not, you know, assume that you're crazy. It's a good first question when you're interviewing people.
That's true. That's absolutely true. I wanted to mention one more thing. I want to go back to the conference that you do once a year at Roe, and just to mention that I know that like me, you are hearing from folks who come to this conference that what they really want is not more information. They want a place where they can touch in with people emotionally and spiritually.
Yeah.
And I am certainly finding that, you know, like people just don't want to see any more charts and graphs.
Yes.
You know, they want to talk about the heart, from the heart. They want to feel this camaraderie with other people. And I just think that right now, community is much more important than collapse information. Would you agree?
Absolutely, I agree. I agree that community is important. Also in response to collapse information. It's important. I mean, the web of connection and relationship that we have around us is our greatest strength. And not only to support us with the emotions that come up in dealing with collapse and facing collapse and, you know, working with reluctant partners and all of the things that come up. I mean, the bottom line is we don't need any more information. The information's already out there. We don't need any convincing. It's, you know, for those of us that are in this place, the convincing is done, and everything else, every other bit of information that comes along is just more, which is not necessary. But so many people also are really viewing this transition, as you've put it so beautifully in your books, as the rite of passage of humanity. And so, you know, what can we go up to the eagle eye perspective and look at what is happening on the planet right now from a much wider lens than from down at the surface where we're all kind of stuck in the stormy sea of our emotions in our day-to-day life. Like, what is happening to human beings from a larger vantage point? And there's lots of people that would like to talk about that from that perspective.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the things I encounter frequently is people who maybe they're just waking up and they become almost obsessed with sitting at their computers and getting more information.
Yeah.
And, you know, oftentimes I will need to tell people, you know, I really think you should back off of that and not look at the news for a week or a month. And that's hard for me to say because I have published for 8 years a daily news digest 7 days a week, you know, that has all this news about, you know, economics, environment, civil liberties, blah, blah, blah. You know, I heavily rely on Peak Prosperity for that.
Yeah.
So to tell people, don't look at the news for a while, you know, that's almost painful to say, but it's so important in some cases because we can really lose ourselves in all of that and become overwhelmed. Has that been your experience?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that in many ways, it can also fall into sort of an addictive pattern.
Yeah.
Where, just one more article. I just need to get one more piece. If I just get that one more piece, then maybe I'll have the answers, whatever those answers are. I've also found that people use the incessant news searching to avoid the emotions that are present in their bodies, right? Because if we're just up in our heads reading news articles, we don't have to feel what's actually going on.
Right.
I also find that people will use internet searching, you know, daily internet searching and news reading to avoid actually doing the things that they know they need to do in terms of preparation.
Right.
So it can be a real avoidance pattern that comes up. So I would really encourage folks to ask people if they're doing it really, really incessantly, what is it that you're hoping to gain? What is it that you're hoping to learn that you don't already know?
Otherwise, we're engaging in what I call collapse porn.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
Just a little bit more of that particular kind of stimulation, right?
Yeah, it stimulates,
it's very stimulating, and it stimulates, you know, a lot of anxiety, it stimulates fear, it stimulates anger, it's very, very stimulating. So I can see where, that terminology is spot on.
Well, listen, Becca, I could talk with you for days, but we're out of time, and I thank you so much for being with us today. This has been incredibly helpful and clarifying.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure, Carolyn. Thank you so much for your work in the world. I really, really appreciate all of the books that you've written, and thank you for the way you're bringing yourself to this field.
Thank you as well, and for your work. BeccaMartinson.com. Contact her. Maybe you'd like to talk with her. You can find her there. And I want to let everyone know that our guest next week will be Paul Levy, author of Dispelling Wetiko and The Madness of George W. Bush. Paul has a new book in press called Awakened by Darkness. And if you're familiar with his work, you know that he has a very incisive perspective regarding the madness of our culture and how we can not only navigate it, but utilize it as an opportunity for experiencing healing and wholeness. So don't miss Paul Levy next Friday right here on the Lifeboat Hour. Goodbye and have a good week, everyone.
Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over.